Hi, good evening. My name is Catherine. I am an alcoholic. And it's a privilege and an honor to be here. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay, fantastic.
This thing picks up pretty well, so just don't worry about it.
Great. We just drove up from Virginia Beach, so I apologize for being a little late. A lot of traffic, you know, coming up out of the area on a Sunday afternoon. My sobriety date is December 2nd of 2009. I have a home group. It's the Simple Actions Group in Norfolk, Virginia. Yes, my home group's in Norfolk, and I live in Virginia Beach. I will drive for a meeting. It's not that far, though, really. And I am sober today by the grace of God. I do have a sponsor. She's actually kind of the one that hooked me into coming here, so you never say no when you get asked, right? What I've been taught is that I share my experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. A lot of times when I start telling my story, a lot was going on when I got to AA to get sober. I had been court-ordered to AA on numerous occasions before I actually came to AA because I wanted what you guys had. And truth be told, I didn't know what you guys had. I just knew I had to stop drinking. I had resigned to myself that a life without alcohol was going to be bleak and miserable and no fun. But that was okay because the fires that I had burning all around me, I wanted out of that. So a boring, miserable life was fine. I'd take it. But I didn't know if it would work for me, truly. I used to listen very closely to what we read in the beginning of the meetings. It says, rarely has a person failed. And so I thought, okay, well, some people fail. that's what I'm thinking. And it really kept talking about, what I kept hearing was, those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And my first sponsor used to always say that to me, just be honest, just be honest. That's all like her mantra. And so somewhere it kind of clicked that, okay, I've got to be honest or I'm going to be one of those that this won't work. And truly, when I did come to get sober, because I'd only been around AA before and to get a paper sign to fulfill a requirement that I had to do. And, of course, once I realized that I could sign my own papers, then the meetings were out the window. It was the great part about it, because I don't know if you guys get a lot of that in your area, but we get a lot of that in Virginia Beach and in Norfolk. And, I always still reach out to those individuals, because what happened when I actually came to AA to get sober is I knew where all the meetings were. I knew which door you had to take to get into the basement of the church, and, I knew where to go. But it wasn't my first thought. When that day came that I had that moment of clarity, and I think there were several moments of clarity, and I don't think it was anything of my doing. It wasn't like I intellectually came to the conclusion that I had to stop drinking, that I couldn't go on like this anymore. I really think it was a spiritual thing, that it was shown to me at a time where I could see it. I couldn't see it before that moment. And, I still have that experience in sobriety. There are certain truths about myself that I cannot see until I can see. I just, everyone else might be able to see, but I can't see. And so when I realized that I had to stop drinking, that I couldn't go on living the way I was living, it was a horrible thought. It was absolutely horrible, because the next thought was, I don't know how. And that was a moment of, even thinking about it now, just utter despair and loneliness. True utter despair and loneliness. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I didn't think, oh, go to AA. It just wasn't the thought. And by the grace of God, I had all these people not from the program kind of put in my path that pushed me in here. And that's how I got here. But I'm just going to back up and kind of tell you, kind of qualify or, tell you what my drinking was like. I think I'm fairly normal, or not normal, but whatever. I'm like an alcoholic in the sense that I love to drink. I love to drink as much as I possibly can consume. I don't really understand drinking that's not that way. you know, having one or two drinks. I just don't understand that. And even today, when that thought, you know, runs across my mind, like, you know, maybe it'd be nice to have a couple of drinks. It's like, Catherine, you never had a couple of drinks. What are you talking about? You know, and that thought, it's still, it's very fleeting. You know, it goes away quickly, but it still comes from time to time. You know, where that first nice day, and I go down to the beach, and, you know, you see the oyster bar, and the boat's pulling up, and you think, oh, wow, it'd be nice to sit out on the deck and have a couple of drinks. But it's gone almost as quickly as it comes in. But when I tell this as part of my story, that I did grow up in an alcoholic home, and the only reason that I talk about that as part of my story is because I learned that dual life almost from day one. That dual life of, you know, what happens at night you don't talk about the next day. You live one life outside of the home than that you live inside the home. You behave one way over here at church than you do over here. And kind of that multiple lives going on, you know. And so that blossomed for me very young and before I ever even started drinking. You know, I couldn't have told you this until after I've been around the program, but I really was kind of always a little dissatisfied with life. I always thought I should have more. I'm the second oldest of six children, so I've had a lot of responsibility at a very young age. And I always thought, boy, wouldn't it be nice if I didn't have all this responsibility, that we could just pick up and go anywhere without having to get all these other kids together. But I wouldn't trade it for the world. You know, I really do love my brothers and sisters. And today we have a relationship. For a long time we did not. And that is something I owe to this program, to the AA. It's something that is probably one of the greatest gifts that have come out of recovery, that my brothers and sisters who wouldn't talk to me for a long period of time would even trust me with their children today in the car. And I will tell you, that is my MO. I drink and I drive. It's just what I do. Certain people do this or do that. I drink and I drive. And so, really, I got pulled over drunk probably for the first time when I was 16 and didn't even get a ticket. They didn't even, suspect me of being drunk. But I knew I was. And I knew I had just left a bar where I had been drinking with a fake ID. I was like, wow, you know, that's pretty cool. They didn't even ask. I wasn't busted. You know, so that always pushing the limit and getting away with things until you get caught. And so I'll just kind of pick out a couple of moments where, you know, I made it through high school. I had always been a good student, never really had to try hard, but I will tell you that I barely got my diploma, because I had missed so many days of school. And I had a teacher that would cover for me and stick up for me to this little disciplinary hearing they had, saying that I was, you know, doing drama and doing this, and that's why I'd miss so many days. So that kind of like, I can do very well, but I just can't seem to get it enough together in order to make the commitment that I'm supposed to do. And that is another thing that runs through my life. When I got to college, I really kind of had a firm resolve that I was going to get my life together. I was going to be that studious college student that I kind of imagined myself to be. And one of the things I did to make that happen was I bought a leather planner. I thought this was very, you know, classy. And, of course, I thought it was going to change everything. And the first night I was there, you know, again, with this firm resolve, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to, you know, take any other illicit substances. Because, really, my whole thing with drinking, and it was altering the way I felt. And I couldn't have told you that until I got sober, but I couldn't stand the way I felt sober. I was filled with anger. I was furious with the home life. I wanted to just escape, just get me out of here. I had these weird views about society that, like, they tell us what to do. You know, we have to do well in school so we go to college, so we can get a good job and buy all this stuff. And I had this, like, crazy kind of thoughts, like, I don't want to do any of that. You know, I don't want to participate in society. And by the time I got here, I really wasn't able to participate as a contributing member of society. Today, I hope it's a little bit different, but I'm still, like, kind of funny. Like, I could do without neighbors, you know, I could do without a lot of things, but... But so I go to college, and literally from day one, it starts again. Roommate, the suite mates are like, let's go to a party. It is going to be at the Knights of Columbus house. And I'm thinking, oh, that's a good Catholic party. This should be great. Within walking up to the steps on the front porch, we're doing keg stands. And it just takes off from there. I mean, there are large chunks of college that I just don't remember. And one of the things I will say that really started in that course of 4 years was that I started isolating and removing myself. So up until then, I have been a very social person, involved in a lot of social circles, all different, all separate, none of them knew each other. But in college, I didn't want to live in the dorms, so I got it moved into an off-campus apartment. Then I didn't want a roommate, so I got my own apartment. Now I'm living alone, and I can drink the way I want to drink, and nobody can say anything about it, because believe you me, even at 19 years old, 18, 19, 20, all that stuff, and I wasn't even legally old enough to drink, people were still concerned about my drinking. One episode that I remember, and I got into a huge philosophical, you know, I love that in our literature when it talks about, you know, how we could wish to be morally philosophical, you know, that a better code of morals would fix us and make us right. So I'm drunk, and I was angry at my suite mates, and the kitchen cabinets were covered with like this material that's like dry erase board. So I take these dry erase markers. We had them in there to leave each other's notes. I covered the entire three cabinets of one side and then the back side all in this just craziness, you know, cuss words and you're horrible and all this stuff. And I left. And then when I came back the next day and saw that, it was horrible. Like, have you ever had anybody try to replay, want you to listen to a message you left them when you were drinking? And you're like, I don't want to hear that. Yeah, I really just erased that. Because it was embarrassing. But none of that was enough to stop drinking. And the discussion then was, is it your true feelings that come out when you're drunk, or is it because you're drunk that you do the insane things? I mean, today it doesn't freaking matter. I am an alcoholic. I cannot stop drinking. Once I drink as much as I can. I like the effect, but I can never quite get that feeling that I'm looking for, that perfect escape from reality and maintain it without things spiraling out of control. So long story short, I get out of college somehow, and again, when I graduated from college, there was a class that I had to pass that final, or else I wouldn't pass the class, and I didn't know quite yet whether I had done that until, you know, after graduation. I mean, I walked and got my diploma, but I didn't know for 100% if I'd actually gotten a diploma. So come home, I'm waitressing down at the oceanfront, and trying to look for a big girl job, and I get one, and it's in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is great news. I get the call that morning, so of course, celebrate. I start drinking, and this had started in college and followed me home. My drink of choice was Jim Beam, and my favorite thing in the world was to have a handle bottle of Jim Beam. Just that was like comfort to me to know that I had enough to drink as much as I wanted. And so, yeah, I'm living with my parents, keeping a handle bottle of Jim Beam in the closet, and it's, you know, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning when I get this call and I start drinking. Well, I've got to work at 3. So I'm driving. I grew up in Chesapeake, in what's now called the Hickory part of Chesapeake. It's like Great Bridge area. So it's about 8 miles from the border of North Carolina. So to get to the oceanfront, it's about a 30-minute drive. So I've got this 30-minute drive. And while I'm on the way to work, I would never have told you that I had blackouts, but I must have blacked out because I don't remember what happened. But I woke up, and my car had smashed into something, and there was another car stopped, and I didn't really know what was going on. And I get out of the car. The lady's like, oh, my God, are you okay? I'm like, I'm fine. I'm so sorry if I hit you. Well, I had smashed into the barrier, that concrete divide that divides on the interstate. And you know, of course, state trooper came. I was arrested for DUI, and I'm telling him, well, I'm on my way to work, and he's just laughing at me. But he really wasn't laughing. This guy was pissed at me. So that was my first DUI the day that I got my first big girl job. So again, you know, make this step, and then I'm right. It's just I cannot seem to get it together. When I moved down to Raleigh, my drinking didn't change any. Again, it was like this new start. I thought it was going to change. I had my own apartment. That job didn't last very long, and I started, you know, working for temp agencies. I'm really good at getting jobs. I just cannot keep them. And I compare stories with people sometimes, and we've laughed to see how many W-2s you've ever had in 1 year. And I've definitely been topped, so that makes me feel good. But, because, yeah, I still have pride and ego, you know, that I like to run my life. But what is kind of fun, and it's not funny, but I will tell you that it was a very pivotal moment for me. One of the lies that I told myself when I was drinking to kind of justify what I was doing and not accept or face the truth about my drinking and about who I was, that I'm an alcoholic, was that I could, you know, I worked full time and I could pay my own bills and I didn't need anybody to take care of me. And it was a lie. And I saw that lie a couple weeks. Well, I take that back. It was about 6 weeks after I got sober when I sat down to work on my resume. And I had been out of college 10 years at that point, and I had 11 jobs on my resume, professional jobs. And when I saw that, I literally, it was like, again, a punch in the stomach. And I had to get up and leave the little office room that I have and, like, literally physically get up, shut the door, and leave the room because I couldn't look at it. It was just this lie that I had been believing about my life for at least 10 years that was totally fake, true. I mean, false. I was delusional. So when I started this period of you know, kind of switching all these jobs, and of course, when I tell you about that resume, it didn't have all the temp agency jobs on there. You know, it would just have that I worked for, you know, this temp agency. I was getting let go a lot. And when I was getting let go, it wasn't specifically always for alcohol. It was oftentimes for my behavior. My behavior was inappropriate. It was inappropriate. I had anger issues. I came to work when I felt like it. I was unable to function as a professional. However, I did have some definite alcohol-related situations, and one, in fact, this temp agency, I had been let go from one position because they said they smelled alcohol on me, and I swore up and down that I hadn't been drinking that day. They gave me another chance. They gave me a good position at this bank, and I just had to be there at 9 o'clock the next day. Well, again, I'm all excited. I've got this great, you know, prospect, and you know, doing my usual thing. It wasn't like I was partying outside of just the normal status quo. You know, drink until 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. Don't hear the alarm. They're calling me, wondering where I'm at. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. I overslept. I'll be right there. They're like, no, you need to come in to our office first. So I come in, and they're like, have you been drinking? No, I haven't. Well, we want to give you breathalyzer. So we go down to one of these 24-hour clinics. And I take a breathalyzer, and, of course, I, you know, had alcohol in my system. And, you know, that they had, I had to have someone come pick me up. They wouldn't let me drive home, you know. And, again, it's like I'm just delusional about the truth of my situation. That's and the part about that that is kind of scary to me and what keeps me so close to the program and to working with a sponsor and staying in the steps and sponsoring people is I know I have the capability to do that sober, to be delusional about my life and believe things that are not true and stake a hold on it, make decisions based on false pieces of information about me. So I need a lot of guidance. But the bottom line is that, you know, there were other instances similar to that. That was just one that, looking back, I cannot believe I argued with these people to the point of going down, and the whole time I'm like, I'm not drunk. And I, clearly I was. So it got to the point where, other substances became involved, and I made another geographic change. So I moved back home. I thought, okay, let's fix it. I'll move in with my parents. I'll get away from these people. Because just like when I went to college, I was going to, stay with the good kids. I always find like finds like. I find my people wherever I go. And so I moved home. And this was the first time I really tried to control my drinking. I do not have experience with trying to stop drinking until I came to AA. So I drank for 16 years. And the longest time during that 16-year span, and I was a daily drinker, was 2 weeks that I spent in jail here, a week that I spent in jail there, because it did not take long for me to start showing up in jails. So with that being said, I did try to start controlling my drinking. And my method of trying to control it was that, I told you I love my handle bottles. I just love them. And I would start buying, the tiniest little, I don't know if it's 750 milliliter or 500 milliliter, travel pint. Not the plastic one, but the little tiny one. And there's another glass size one in between that. So I would start buying those, and I could have one a night. And that got to be very difficult to coordinate getting to the ABC store every day. And so I started getting the next size up, which was double. So my rule was you just have half. Of course, you know how that goes. Just one more, a little bit more. And so now I'm drinking one of those every day. Well, that's a lot of trouble, so I'm just going to go up to the plastic traveler, And it wasn't long before I was right back to doing what I always do. And it was so funny, that closet. I had one of those cloth shoe bags that hang on the back of the door, and that's where I kept all my little bottles. It was terrible. You'd open the door, and it would, you could hear the glass, clanking. It was terrible. And, that was still an alcoholic home, so you can only imagine the debacles that occurred between myself and other family members. It was just ugly stuff. Yeah, that's okay. I am fine about the skirt, but I just want to get the floor. So, anyways, while we're trying to clean that up, what do I do now? at that point, I'm living back home, and I already had told you I had one DUI. I ended up getting a second DUI, and it was just that one was crazy because there were five police cars that pulled me over, and apparently they had been following me for a long time, and it was in my parents' neighborhood, so I called them as I was, I see all these police cars, and literally right around the corner from turning into their street, and I was like, please come down here, I'm getting arrested, and so it's 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever, my poor parents are getting out of bed, coming down to see me get arrested and hauled off, and at that point, legally, I know laws have changed, but I had just gotten, I was maybe a couple months shy of being two within 5 years, so they looked at it a little bit differently. And I fought that one, thinking I could get out of that. And, and I will tell you, my first run-in with getting in trouble was actually in college. I had gotten a possession charge, and I totally believed it was all set up. It was totally a setup. They had a fire alarm, got us out of there, and they went in there, and were like, oh, look what we found. And, so it wasn't my fault. And that's when I was first ordered to go to ASAP, which is alcohol safety. And I got kicked out of there for showing up drunk. So then I had to go to the more intensive therapy, one-on-one. And totally not believing I had any type of problem. So thank you. So this is now the third time. And I fought that one, but what happened, and that was when I did have to do 2 weeks in jail. And every time I had been arrested, it was, you're so kind. Thank you so much. Thank you. There's like a little bar down here that I didn't see that it like. I guess I set it on it and just flipped over.
That's our trap.
Yeah. So, anyways, every time I was arrested, I'm sitting in jail and I keep thinking about how I'm going to get out of this. That time with that DUI, my thought was I had to move. I'll move to California because they have a lot of public transportation there. I don't know. I mean, it was just out of control. I didn't move, but what I did do was I moved out of my parents' house. And I moved in with a girl because now I don't have a license for a very long time, but I plan to continue driving, and, you know, I can't do that while I'm there. So I move in with a friend of mine, and, of course, it doesn't take long for her to go, like, whoa, you are out of control, girl. And so, long story short, I end up getting my own place again. And I still live there to this day. It's a little town home. And, man, that things really got out of control when I got there. It just, I had gotten to a place where I couldn't, I was antisocial. And I mean that really from a behavior standpoint, like antisocial behavior. Inappropriate, mean, aggressive. And so I started drinking alone. And I had always drank alone, but it was like to try to get drunk before going anywhere. But now it really was drinking alone. And the weekends became, I got to a point where I so looked forward to any extended periods of time without working. And that's when I would really start binging. You know, like if I could stay drunk for 2 weeks at a time, it would be awesome. And, you know, like that week between Christmas and New Year's. Or, you know, you have a three-day weekend and you could take, you know, two more days off and just stay drunk for 5 days straight. And so I started getting that habit of basically from Friday, I would start drinking till Sunday night. And it would be, you know, I would get drunk and pass out, wake up drunk, and then pass out. And it was like, it didn't matter what time I woke up. It might be 10 o'clock, you know, I'd get home at 5, I might pass out and wake up by 10 or 2 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning. It didn't matter. I would just start drinking again. And by the time Sunday night rolled around, I'm like, oh my God, I got to go to work tomorrow. And Monday I would be so sick. And not necessarily like throwing up in the bathroom sick, but just those sweats. And the company I worked for at that time, it was this little kind of tech company. I was a salesperson for them. I had gone into sales, and it worked. It was a great fit for me because you don't have to report to the office at the same time every day. You can say you got a meeting. And so it was great for my lifestyle. I could just say I had meetings or whatever. Which brings me to a funny story. I got in trouble for driving without a license, and it wasn't just suspended, you know, like the revoked kind, and, you know, where you do have to go to jail. And in order to get my license back, I had to put one of those breathalyzers in, which was horrible because I was never not drunk. And so I know, how am I going to drive now? So I bought a breathalyzer online, and I would test myself before I went to start the car because, you know, you get like three strikes and you're like out. And I realized in the mornings that I was still had a BAC, and I realized if I like ran around and got my heart rate up, it would drop my BAC. So in the mornings, I'd be trying to get to work, and I can't start the car. So now I'm running around the house, up and down the stairs, you know, and trying to get my heart rate up. And then, you know, blowing and going, okay, it's not down yet. So, you know, now we're doing it again. And I remember my girlfriend that I worked with, and we drank together. We were one in a kind, or, you know, one in the same. So we would cover for each other a lot. She would call me like, Catherine, are you coming in? You know, we have that big meet. I'm like, I know, Linda, I can't get my car started yet. She's like, well, you better hurry. So, you know, I mean, this is the kind of, you know, shenanigans I'm doing. But I had gotten fired from that job, so I went over and worked for this little tech company. It was just a couple of guys started it, and there was maybe a receptionist, and then, like, the guys who actually did the support of the computers. And the bathrooms there were just gross. They were just not good. And I'd be in there sitting on the floor, just so sick, just praying no one would come and knock on the door, you know, just sweating and sweating and sweating. And I don't know if you've ever been in those situations, but it is utter hell. And then I'd come home from work on Monday, just so sick. I mean, all I could do is go straight to the couch. And I'd start watching that show, Intervention. And, you know, because it would come on Monday nights. And now, I don't know, I haven't watched it in years, but I don't know when they air it now. But it was kind of new then. And so I would start comparing myself, like, I'm not that bad. You know, I'm not. By 8, 9 o'clock, I would be feeling well enough to have a couple of drinks. And I convinced myself that I wasn't that bad, so it was okay. You know, I wasn't living on the street corner. I wasn't, you know, robbing people. Even though I stole, I mean, good God. I wouldn't have admitted to it until I came here. But the bottom line is that stuff was getting really out of control. So that job that I had, this little tech company, there were some incidents. You know, I was kind of not, you know, you see the writing on the wall. And a lot of jobs that I left, it wasn't necessarily because I got fired. It's just I saw the writing on the wall, and it's like, well, I'll take the high road. I'll get out of here before they can fire me. And I saw that coming with this job, and that last night, the night before I got fired, we had this, and God, it's like when I read this book the first time, I identified so much. It told my story. You know, particularly like getting drunk at all the wrong times when there's that big meeting to keep, that big appointment, and just cannot seem to stay sober for it. We had this big presentation the next day with this law firm, you know, do services for them. Of course, I'm the salesperson. I'd worked the day before getting all these presentations together, and the long and short of it is that I got drunk the night before. I was partying, and that morning came around, and I was like, I can't do this. And I remember as I'm walking out the door, and I told the friend that had stayed over, I was like, look, will you just go down there with me? I'm going to drop these presentations off because I've got the presentations for this big meeting. I'm going to drop these presentations off, tell them I'm sick, I can't stay, and we'll leave. And so I remember no shower, nothing, just throwing on some clothes and going in the kitchen and taking a shot as I head out the door, you know, to get to this meeting. And the gentleman was like, you know, I told him, my boss was like, what are you doing? You know, what's going on with you? And I'm like, I'm not well, I got to go. And he sees this other person with me, and he's like, who the hell is that? Like, what? It's all weird. So he's like, I need to see you then tomorrow morning. And I knew what was going to happen. I knew. So the next morning comes around, I go in to see him. You know, the whole speech, firing, all that stuff, I've heard a million times. So I leave, I go home, and I start drinking. And in my mind, I had just made the decision that this was the last responsibility that was off the table. And I was on the biggest bender of my life. And I'll tell you what, I was looking forward to it. I was looking forward to that. And when I say the longest, I mean like I was thinking I could go for months. And I was relishing that. Like, this is going to be good. And later that day, around 4 or so, I realized I'd left some cord for my phone, like a charger cord or whatever. And I had to have it. Just had to get that. So I get behind the wheel of the car. It's rush hour traffic on a Friday afternoon to go from Virginia Beach to Norfolk. And it was raining. And that interchange, there's an interchange where it's kind of a little tricky. There's like, you know, interstates going off in different directions. I'm impatient in traffic. So I, you know, quick cut over to get around this car, and the traffic in that next lane's completely stopped. And I slam into the back of this truck. And my first thought, and when I say slam into it, I mean, you know, full 360-degree spin. I hadn't been in an accident that bad. Prior that year, prior to this specific day, I had been in 3 accidents that year where I was the only car involved. Out kind of on country roads like this, just getting an accident. Call the insurance company. Where you at? I don't know. And that spring, this was on October, that day was October 19th of 2009. That spring, I remember one day I came home, I was out seeing clients, and I came home at lunch, and I remember going up to my room to get something. And I don't know why that day, I was not a praying person. I didn't have any type of religious or spiritual life whatsoever. I remember sitting on my bed that day and just looking out the window, and just thinking, God, what is it that you want in my life? Like, I started, like, it was just a random thought, but I never really had that thought before. And I tried going back to church. It was in the spring, so it was right around Easter time. And started going. I remember I would go to like 7 o'clock mass, drunk, thinking I'm going to find God or something. I don't know. But I look back on it knowing that I was searching. There was a hole there, and I could not fill it, and I didn't know what would, but I was looking. But, of course, like anything, that wasn't a solution for me. Alcohol was, so it lasted maybe 5 or 6 weeks, and I was done. But when on that day when I got in this accident, I called a friend, and they wouldn't come help me, and I was really pissed. I'm in the car, and I'm just so angry, and I'm like, I've got to get out of here. All I can think of was, I've got to get out of here because I'm going to get a third DUI. I just got to go. So I take off, and just furious but scared. I mean, it was a really bad wreck, and I'm very disoriented at this point. And so I'm driving down 264, and it's quite a bit of ways to the next exit. And I can't see because the hood's all smashed up. So I'm trying to look between. I don't know if you guys ever saw it in a driver's ed manual. I remember seeing it and laughing hysterically because it's like, you know, if you can't see, if something happens with your hood, you try to either roll down the window and stick your head out or you look through the little crack. So I was trying to look through a little crack. So I'm driving on an interstate, trying to look through a little crack, and the airbag had deployed. So, I mean, it was like a mess inside the car, and I'm just, all I can think about is, I got to hide, I got to get out of here. So I pull off this exit. It's a very industrial area, and I pulled in the first industrial park entrance, and I think the business I pulled up to was like serviced diesel trucks or something. And I went in there and asked, I'm like, I need some help. I need to get a tow truck or something and a ride home. And the owner of the business, you know, this is like Friday at 5 o'clock. Everybody's trying to go home, you know. And then our business sits down, and he's like, here, you can come in my office. And he's looking at me. He's like, do you know you're drunk? And I'm like, I know. And he's like, okay, well, you know, you can use the phone to call a tow truck. So he let me use the phone, and, of course, I couldn't find anyone because it had been raining. What had happened was there was actually another accident, literally. Like, I'm on the left side of the interstate, and there was another accident on the right side, same direction, with a state trooper there. I mean, that's how brazen. I mean, there's a state trooper right there, and I'm taking off from this accident. So when I tried to get a tow truck, they were all tied up. There were accidents all over because it was raining. And so he helped me get a tow truck, however. And it wasn't until they came that I looked into the car to get my personal stuff out. And I found I wear glasses or contacts. I had glasses on at the time. And they were in the back seat. So I not only have been driving, not being able to see, but I didn't have my glasses on, and I can't see far away. So it was just all messed up. And basically what happened is that next morning, you know, I came home that night. I continued drinking. And that next morning I woke up to, well, it wasn't a knock. It was more like the pounding. And I knew before I even went to look out the window who it was. I just knew. And I called a friend to say, I think the police are here to arrest me. And they're like, well, there's nothing I can do. I mean, this is the kind of how people reacted to my phone calls at that point in my life. I can't help you. There's nothing I can do. You're on your own for this one. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with me. And so I was arrested. And the state trooper told me in the car, first off, he was pissed at me too because he had gone looking for me and didn't find me. And he had gone, you know, I said it was at an interchange. He had gone heading towards Chesapeake when I had gone heading towards Norfolk. So only two questions I asked him in that ride was, one was, well, how did you find me? And he said, well, people were calling in on the interstate saying there's this car driving down the interstate with smoke coming out of it and car parts falling off. So they're like getting my license plate number. It's like, okay. And then he told me that I was probably not going to get bail because the other two people I hit had been taken to the hospital. I'd never even thought about them. Never crossed my mind until that moment. And I will tell you that first sense of resign when I heard that that someone was there. It was just like I had resigned myself. And it was another resignment. Like, oh my God, I've done something. You know that invisible line in the sand, I'm never going to cross it, and then it gets redrawn and it gets redrawn. It was like I was at a point where I didn't know how to redraw that. And the only other question I asked him was, are they okay? And he said he didn't know yet at that point. He had called the hospital and hadn't given an update. So that's the state of mind going into to jail. And I did end up getting bonded out. Of course, my poor dad, this is like another jail that he had to pick me up from. And no one in my family's ever even been arrested or been to jail, you know. So it's not like I grew up around this. But the bottom line is that while I was sitting in there, I had no thoughts of how am I going to get out of this one. That wasn't a thought in my mind, which that was different. I also saw, and I don't mean like a vision, like some type of vision, I don't know how to explain it, but it was like I saw what was going to happen, that I was going to kill someone. There was nothing I could do to stop it. And then it was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to stop drinking. And that's when it started for me. And that thought after, you know, these series of thoughts, it was like, oh my God, like there go my dreams of, you know, retiring on the beach with a little drink with the umbrella. Of course, I never drank like that anyways. I drank alone in my kitchen taking shots. That's how I drank, you know. So what I started doing next, I don't know why, but I started trying to say the Our Father. And I couldn't even remember the prayer. So all I could say was, Our Father who art in heaven. Our Father who art in heaven. I just started saying it over and over. And I started to feel some peace. And then the next line came in, hallowed be thy name. So now I'm saying that over and over. And that was kind of how I just sat in that moment without trying to escape, without thinking about what am I going to do next. I just sat through that moment just saying that over and over. So I get out. I go see an attorney because I got a hearing that Wednesday. And so basically, just to sum it up, in 24 hours, I lost my job, totaled my car, got charged with a felony, almost killed two people, and had a moment of clarity given to me, not by my own, you know, conclusions. And still no thought of going to AA. So I go see this attorney. I tell him my rap sheet, if you will, what's going on, what I have, and what the charge is now. Because, of course, you know, I tell him the charge, well, what have you had in the past? Long story short, I tell him all this list of stuff. And he just looks at me and he's like, what are you going to do about your drinking? And I just look at him and I'm not sobbing, but tears are coming down the side of my face. I'm just like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do about it. So he hands me a brochure for this place and he starts telling me how I need to get my butt in AA. And that was on Monday. I thought that first preliminary court hearing was on Wednesday. So I see him again on Wednesday. And I did drink that night I came home from jail was the first time I could ever admit to myself that I really drank because I had to. Like, I had to drink that night. Even signing the paperwork to get out of jail, my hands were so shaky I could barely write. And that had started happening that year. In the morning, trying to put on mascara, my hands are so shaky I can't even get mascara on my eyes. So I would have never told you I had the shakes, but I had them. That Wednesday when I see him again, he asked me if I had been to AA. Now, this attorney is not an AA. He's not an alcoholic because we've maintained a relationship since then, and he'll occasionally send people my way. But he starts telling me some story about some movie reference with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and my attention span has been so short for years that I haven't watched a lot of movies in a long time. But basically, I didn't quite get the gist of what he was talking about. It was some, like, war scene and talking about how your life depends on it. And he's like, well, that's how you need to be with AA. So I come home from court. I hadn't had a drink that day. The drink I had the night before, I had been cleaning out my cabinet, so I had drank, like, some wine and some old beer, and then I found, like, some rum. I made, like, a rum and Diet Coke, and it was, whoop. I know, it was awful. But I had cleaned the house out, so I had no more alcohol in the house at that point in time. And then I ended up, after about an hour, calling AA, the intergroup office. And this guy, Bill, answered the phone. I didn't know him at the time. I know him now, and he's since retired last year from working in the intergroup office. But I asked him if there was anyone that could give me a ride to a meeting. And he said that typically they didn't do that. And I gave him my sob story. Well, I don't have a car, and there's this meeting at 8 o'clock. It's pretty close, but I'll have to walk down like an 8-lane, or, walk, because I didn't even have a bike. I'll have to walk down an 8-lane highway at night in dark. It was already dark at that point. So he said, well, look, I'll call. If I can't find a woman to pick you up, I'll call you by 5 o'clock and let you know. All right, so I'm on the couch for the rest of the day. I really can't do anything. I don't know if this is me detoxing. I don't know, but I couldn't do anything. TV's on, but I can't even like follow the story. Can't sit still with myself. I just can't do anything. I'm just so uncomfortable. Try to sleep. I can't sleep. So I'm looking at the clock, and 5 o'clock is approaching. Nobody's called. I'm thinking, whew, because I don't really, that was probably too hasty to call them. And about 5:02, the phone rings. And it's this lady, Shelley. And Shelley sounded very nice, and she said she would pick me up. And I told her where I lived. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess I better get up and get dressed and get myself together to go to this meeting. So she picks me up. And when I had come home from that arrest, I remember thinking that I didn't want to write anything down because I was afraid someone was going to search my house. I had wanted to, I had gone through a litany of ways that I could probably try to kill myself. But I couldn't follow that through. I was really paranoid, really in a lot of despair, and I didn't want to tell anybody what was going on. So the only people that knew were the person I called when I got in the wreck, and they didn't know about the charges. The person I called when I knew the police were there, and my parents, because they had bailed me out of jail. Nobody knew. And this lady picks me up, and I don't know her from Adam. I get in the car, and I just start telling her everything that's going on. I don't even know why. And I got to tell you, it felt like this huge weight off my chest. Of course, her jaw's just dropping. But amazingly enough, she starts telling me what happened to her. And she had a very similar story. And felony charges, whole nine yards. And I'm looking at her. She's got a job. She looks like she takes care of herself. I had stopped taking care of myself, really. Just looks like she has her shit together, which is something I could never seem to do. I could do it, but I couldn't maintain it. And we went to this meeting, and they were all very nice to me. And basically, I made a decision that night. And I don't want to say that I made the decision, but something inside of me said, okay, this is it. You're either going to try this or you're not. And I said, I will try it. If I'm one of those that are constitutionally incapable of being honest, then so be it. But I want to find out. Well, the next 10 days were pretty unbearable. I don't see where the clock is. Oh, now I see it. Okay. The next 10 days were pretty unbearable. And that was where, what I mean by unbearable, I was going to 2 meetings a day. But the unbearable part was just not being able to be comfortable in my own skin. I wanted to pull my hair out. I would have done anything not to feel the way I was feeling. And I found that brochure that attorney had given me for this recovery house. So I called them up, and I went there for 30 days. And basically what we did there was, it's Edge Hill in Winchester. I don't know if any of y'all have ever been there. But all we did was go to meetings all day. And I got a sponsor there because you could go meet with them, go get coffee. And I wanted that, so I got a sponsor so I could have that. And so I was in a meeting, and I did what I was told, basically, like, listen for somebody who was sharing something that touched my heart. So I heard this woman sharing. I went and asked her. She would sponsor me, be my temporary sponsor. And she said, sure, you got a copy of the big book. I said, yes, I do. She said, well, read the first 164 pages, highlight, anything that speaks to you, and then give me a call. And I'm like, shit, you want me to read the whole 164 pages? But I was serious about it, so I did. And I got, oh my gosh, I got picked on because I'd be sitting around reading the big book, and everyone else is like, what in the world are you doing, girl? Because, majority of the people there weren't really serious about getting sober. And I had been that way for years, forced to do things I didn't want to do, so I'm just going to check the boxes so I can go on with my life. And it was actually really cool. I did bond with this woman, and I remember she took me out to her farm. She had lambs that had just had little calves? No. Well, they were baby lambs. And she took me out there. It was dark. And I just remember sitting there with her, with all these little baby lambs crawling all over us. And the only reason I talk about this stuff is it's like life was slowly changing for me and seeing things that in a different way. And I came in without any hope. And it is truly through sponsorship that I got let out of that. I know it's God, and I know it's God working through other women. But they really did lead me out of that. And it wasn't like some big, you know, I'm going to work all the steps in the first 3 months, or I'm going to do a step a month, or this or that. Because of various circumstances, I have had different sponsors. And so they've all kind of been a little bit different in how they've walked me through the program. Some are very, okay, today we're going to work step one. And then I've had others that just kind of like, we're going to go through, we're going to live life. And we're going to talk about the steps as we do this, you know, as things come up. So, and then I had Thanksgiving with this woman and all her huge whole family. It was wonderful. It was uncomfortable, you know, but that's how I was, like, learning to be social and learning how to, like, behave and be appropriate. And, you know, I mean, I really grew up in AA. When I came back, I did get a home group right away. I did have issues with other substances. So that first time I came back, I did get high. And it was the last time it ever happened. So that's why my sobriety date is December 2nd, even though last time I got drunk was October 19th. I've always only been in AA. I did try our sister fellowship for a minute because I thought that might be what led me out, but I realized I belonged here. And I guess I'm just going to close with this. It's nothing really monumental or beautiful or wonderful, but, you know, today my life is completely different. The things that I do at work, the things that I do, I'm very active in my church today, which I was not. That is part of my story. All the things that I do, all those places I learned to do in here. How to go up and shake someone's hand, how to set up chairs, how to make coffee. I have a great relationship with my sponsor today, and my sponsorship family means so much to me. My mom just passed away from this disease a month ago, and she could not get sober. And I didn't think all those years that I was drinking that I was going to die from alcoholism, but it freaking happens. And so my very life depends on this. It is a gift, and I have a life today. It does not always measure up to my expectations and standards in more ways than one. But the bottom line is that God does provide everything I need. It took a year and a half for all the court stuff to be wrestled out. But what happened that last hearing that I went to, because of points and all this stuff, I had about 17 months of jail time they wanted to give me. And that prosecutor, boy, she was vicious. I mean, she wanted me prosecuted. And every time we'd go into court, every hearing, she'd hold up the pictures of my car and say, I don't know how she walked away from drove away from this wreck, much less walked away, because it was awful. But I got up, you know, judge is about to give his ruling. Well, I had already been pled guilty, let me put it that way, and then they were going to give my sentence, which is when you're actually technically convicted. And he looked up from his paperwork, bailiff had moved behind me, and said, I've reduced these charges to failure to report an accident. Time served, you have to pay this fine. Go see the clerk. And it was like everybody's jaws just dropped open. Like, how could that happen? And when I was in jail, I didn't understand why I had lived. And that was part of the reason why I started praying, because I couldn't imagine a human power that could have made that happen. And it was the first time I thought, maybe God wants me here for something. And that whole first year and a half, when I was not knowing what the outcome was going to be, my prayers consisted of, God, whatever you want to do with my life, because I hadn't memorized for third step prayer by then, but whatever you want to do with my life, it's in your hands. If it's to go to jail or to prison, I understand that's your plan and I accept it. If it's not, that's fine too. It was the first time I just gave it over, put it all out there and said, whatever the outcome is, I'm okay with it. And that's where I got peace. And so I wish that that came as easily to me today on everything, but it doesn't. But that's the foundation. Thank you. I appreciate you listening to my story.